Spoken word.
A taste of Melbourne's diverse poetry scene.
Poets using their voices to entertain, to move, to take you on a journey.
Connecting you to grassroots poetry and performance.
Good morning and welcome to the 3CR Spoken Word Program. My name is Di Cousins and I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation and elders past and present. My guest today is Robert DiNapoli, who is a retired but active scholar of medieval English literature. Welcome to the program, Bob.
Thanks very much, Di. It's great to be back.
Yeah, it's so good to have you in again. And congratulations on your new book, Reading Old English Riddles, The Dark Glass. So this is a translation and a commentary on a very extraordinary text. What is the text?
The text is what's referred to as the Exeter Book Riddles. They were collected in a single manuscript, which is a kind of Norton anthology of Old English poetry. It's a big compendium, nothing but poetry, of every kind that we know was composed during the Anglo-Saxon period. It's the only purpose-designed anthology of that kind that survives, so we're very fortunate to have it. And the riddles form a large part of it.
And I think we need to note a couple of things. So the first is that this is the Anglo-Saxon period, which is the period after the Romans left in the 5th century and before the Battle of Hastings in 1066. So what is the Anglo-Saxon period and what language are they using?
Okay, well, they're using what linguists call Old English as opposed to Middle English and Modern English. So Middle English would be the language of Chaucer, which is an in-between stage, not surprisingly. Old English is much, much nearer to English's Germanic origins. I had a linguistics teacher once who taught it that Chaucer, the Middle English, is pronounced like Old English, but its grammar is much more modern. And so that those sound changes that eventually make Old English sound so strange happen well late in the day or across a long period of time. In its own time, look, it's a Germanic language. It uses a lot of vocabulary that German speakers can recognize. And much of its vocabulary is basically cognate with German. Both modern German and Old English go back to a common primitive Germanic ancestor, if you like. They're cousins, more or less. And it was the language of basically Northwestern Europe throughout, you know, going back as far as we know. I mean, it eventually, there's an earlier stage that's referred to as primitive Germanic, but we don't know a whole lot about it because we don't have manuscript leavings.
Yeah.
And happily, because of the accidents of history, the Anglo-Saxons got converted to Christianity fairly early, as these things go, among the Germanic people. They were among the first. And that means they acquired, I've talked about this before, they acquired the whole superstructure of Christian literacy when they took to Christianity. They got monasteries. Monasteries had scriptoria, which were their writing labs, if you like. And they got literacy, which they didn't really have prior to the coming of Christianity. So everything we have in Old English is written in an adapted Roman alphabet, which is more or less the letters we know with a few add-ons, that was literally adapted to the sounds of Old English, which were not identical to the sounds of Latin. So it took some nipping and tucking to make it work. And that's what happened, basically. I mean, there's a few good stories to tell about how native poetry got to be composed and written down. Let's just say it did.
Yeah.
And we have some of the earliest examples of vernacular, i.e. non-Latin poetry in those manuscripts. We're the envy of the European medieval world because we got lots of stuff to play with.
Yes. And is Beowulf in Old English?
Oh, yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that also dates to this period between the Romans and 1066.
That's a safe guess.
Right. And in terms of things being written down prior to Old English, things are written down in Latin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you mention runes in the commentary a bit. So there are some inscriptions and...
Well, there are some riddles that use runes. There's also a dedicated poem that's not a riddle, and it's been named by scholars the rune poem, which is takes the runic alphabet and does a little short stanza on each letter, because the letters have names that are common nouns. That's the one vestige of pre-Christian literacy that we have. But you can tell it wasn't common literacy, because the runes are made by straight lines cut in different, mainly vertical and diagonal, never horizontal, because one of the uses they were for was for inscribing on wood sticks. And so if you go horizontal, the line would get lost in the grain.
Yeah.
And but they're for carving,
right,
more or less. In fact, our word write comes from the Old English word ritan, whose literal original meaning is to incise or to inscribe. And that was about cutting runes into rows. So you could only do short texts with that. You get runic inscriptions of people's names on headstones. They're used for abbreviations in manuscripts, and that's about it.
And just for completeness, mm-hmm. where did the runes come from?
Nobody knows.
Okay,
it's a mystery. The word rune in Old English means mystery. It doesn't mean a runic letter.
Okay.
They use a compound rune stuff for an actual character in the runic alphabet. But the word rune means mystery. There's a verb, runan, that means to whisper.
Right.
Conspiratorially, something that suggests but doesn't tell you. So they're associated. I mean, you can go into any New Age bookshop and get fortune-telling runes that are no doubt a lot of fun for a lot of people, but not based on anything historical that we know of.
Sure.
But there we are.
So anyway, it's an interesting time, mm-hmm. you know, that we have these vestiges of literate writings, you know, and memory. And when we come to the riddles, they're written as often a personification of an object or an animal, mm-hmm. saying, I am like this and I am like that. Mm-hmm. And then there isn't actually a solution to the riddle given. You have to work it out.
No.
So do we have any idea why these riddles came about? Was it a form of playfulness or?
No doubt. I talk in my introduction about the play of cognitive uncertainty, and of course riddles remain a form of play to this day. You're most likely to encounter collections of riddles in the children's section. You know, but think of what that means. I mean, it's not just that they're kiddie stuff, but that they are meant to prod uncertain cognitive states. And that's really what they're about. I think they're a way of filtering reality, especially with the first-person riddles, where you've got the irony of the solution itself sitting opposite you and talking to you and telling you what it is right in front of you. You know, work me out, bright boy. Everything poses a challenge in that way. As I say, we look at reality and reality looks back. We speak reality and reality speaks back. And I think the riddles are one of the really psychologically fascinating aspects of how that happens.
So just having a look at your wonderful new book, Reading Old English Riddles, The Dark Glass,
mm-hmm.
Let's start with reading in modern English the riddle on page 19, and we won't go to what it is until the end. We'll give the solution at the end.
Okay. And as it happens, this is the one that I really wanted to read in Old English because it's quite short.
Yeah, well, you can read it in Old English after first read it in English and then read it in Old English.
Okay, if you want to do it that way.
Yeah.
Fair enough. And it goes like this. A moth devoured words, To me, that seemed an extraordinary fate when I was told that wonder, that the worm, the thief in darkness, gulped down a man's sayings, his majestic speech, and its solid foundations. The thieving visitant was no whit the wiser for all the words he'd wolfed.
And so what's the solution? What is this moth that devoured words?
The answer is hiding in plain sight here, and it's a bookworm.
Right.
Okay, which is not a moth, and moths don't eat books. So, you know, it's an imposition, a cognitive imposition to suggest that a moth is eating the words. That's part. The riddles traffic in creative indirection, where they're giving you clues that turn out to be real clues, but that at first listen, steer you the wrong way. And that's part of the fun.
Yeah. So it's the larva of the moth that's the bookworm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Would you like to read it in Old English?
Oh, yes. Let me do that. It sounds something like this. Motha ward frat, me that thuchta, ratli chu weird, tha itch that wunder ye fryen, that's a worm for swelch, where are yeed summas. Theof in thistro, thrum fastna quida, and the stronga stadol, stallius newas, wichteth e glaura, the he tham wardum swelch.
Incredible.
It's lots of fun.
Yeah, and where does Old Norse come into all these languages?
It's another cousin. Old English comes from the West Germanic subgrouping in Germanic languages, and Old Norse is the progenitor of the North Germanic one. That's where all the Scandinavian languages come from. So they have lots and lots of cognates between them. The relationship between Old Norse and Old English is like between Spanish and Portuguese. You can tell their family.
Right.
In that sense.
Okay. And what else would you like to say about this riddle?
Oh my gosh, what might I not say? The main piece of fun with it is that if you're a scribe in a medieval scriptorium, the bookworm is your enemy. You know, you are trying most of the time to transcribe works of eternal wisdom, the word of God, that you are going to put down on vellum pages in a codex. And if you've ever handled vellum or handled old vellum from like 800, 900, 10 AD, that stuff is tough as. It lasts and lasts and lasts. So on the one hand, you're putting down for the ages. You're writing down eternal wisdom for the ages. And what does this little worm do? It reduces it to dust. And that's the irony of the poem. It seizes on the words on the page and gets nothing out of them. It can eat them. And of course, there's all kinds of alimentary metaphors in patristic writings for how you take in text. You have to chew it over. You have to literally ruminate on it, you know, which is an agricultural term for ruminant animals, but it also means to read carefully in that way. So in that sense, the pious Christian is a bookworm in the sense that you were asking about, of being someone who gets lost in a book, you know, or concentrates, you know, exceedingly on a book. But the bookworm doesn't get it. And in fact, it undoes all the work of the scribe and ultimately the source of all this, which is the Bible in the first instance. And the last riddle that I'll talk about either now or in the next session, the spoken word, is all about that and what's the really lasting thing. But we'll talk about that in time.
Let's move on to the riddle about fire.
Okay. A warrior exists upon the earth, wondrously conceived, of use to men, brought forth, bright, by an unspeaking pair. An enemy assails him, foe on foe. A woman often envelops him, too strong. He bears himself well and serves them patiently, if men and maids alike attend to him, with due restraint and feed him properly. He in turn lifts them with benefits, makes life a pleasure. Grimly, he repays those who let him rise too arrogantly.
There's a lot of personification mm-hmm. in these poems.
Well, I've mentioned, I think in my introduction, that It's about half and half the first-person riddles where the solution is speaking to you in its own voice, and the other half are, I saw a marvelous creature, I saw the strange thing, and it's a third-person narration. And the thing is, the third-person ones are almost as morphic, if I can put it that way, as the first-person ones, because they give you the sense of the thing being observed as a living creature. And so there's a lot of personification, a lot of anthropomorphism.
Yes. And it's a warrior exists upon the earth, wondrously conceived, of use to men, brought forth bright by an unspeaking pair. What's an unspeaking pair?
Think of how you would make a fire. Without matches.
Rubbing two sticks.
It would be rubbing
together.
Two sticks or okay. Striking for with flint.
Oh, okay.
Sparks from steel. Those would be the two common ways of generating fire. So that's the unspeaking pair.
And what's a woman often envelops him too strong?
That's probably going to reflect the part of woman in the domestic routine. So maybe in a stove, in a hearth, she would be tending the fires.
Yeah, the women as that guardian of the hearth, like the old goddess Hestia.
Pretty much. And if it needed extinguishing at the end of the day, it would be her part to put it out. Yeah.
Right. Grimly he repays those who let him rise too arrogantly.
Most dwellings in Anglo-Saxon England were wood and thatch.
Right. So fairly vulnerable to fire.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm still pondering about the kind of energy behind creating the riddles, you know, where it came from.
Yeah, wouldn't we like to know?
Right.
Look, all I can say is, having studied most of every other kind of old English poetry over the decades, there is something here in the way this fire is being characterized that it is in touch with the mainstream of Old English poetic diction, because it's primarily about reciprocity, is the best way I can put it, especially in the heroic stuff that's even pre-Christian. You know, the Lord is served by a body of retainers who are his people, and they owe him complete loyalty, service, they fight and die for him, but he owes them the same, more or less, and there's no absolute dictator in Anglo-Saxon literary culture, at least. Everybody has to have everybody else's back. That's probably a reflex of the migration age, where things were so tenuous and everybody had to look out for everybody else. And so there's this mutuality that's at the heart of it. And this fire does the same thing. He serves them well if they look after him. So, you know, one looks after the other, looks after the other kind of thing. It's quite fetching.
And because I think some of us are not overly familiar with the Anglo-Saxon period in British history.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time, it was still called Britannia, wasn't it?
Well, it was Britannia when the Anglo-Saxons arrived.
Okay.
And it was full of Britons who got the boot and became the Welsh and the Cornish and the Irish and the Scots on the periphery of the land that nobody else wanted. That's overstating it, but you get the idea. And the Anglo-Saxons didn't really change the name of the land. It took a little while. And it was apparently the Angles, of the three tribes, the Anglo-Saxons and Jutes, who came across and eventually took over the place. It was the Angles who gave their name to it. We're not entirely sure why. But it became Angla-land, which is the land of the Angles. And then that got abbreviated ultimately to England. And but it didn't happen straight away. It's first mentioned around the reign of King Alfred, where you get mentions.
And what century is King Alfred?
He dies in 899.
Okay.
So he's 9th century.
Yeah.
And it's at that point. You get, interestingly, in earlier chronicle entries, you get different kings who come to the top of the heap. There's a number of really petty kingdoms that comprise England. And no one of them is really boss of the whole show, but some of them pretend to be. And they assume a title, which is Bretwalda. And it means literally the Walda is the wielder, the governor of the Britons. And so they do refer to themselves that way when they're trying to put on airs and pretend that they're the head honcho, if I can put it that way. But you don't really get mention, you don't get mention of Englaland until the chronicle entries around King Alfred in the later 800s. So it takes a while.
And so the kind of world we're imagining is like the world in Beowulf, which is with mead halls and the lord sitting at the head
That's a tough call. The poets like to imagine that.
Okay.
You know, and there are prose narratives that survive as well that have the feel of that really old, you know, pre-Christian, maybe even continental Germanic stage. And it's hard to tell exactly what was going on the ground. If you read a poem like Beowulf, you see, you know, the kings of mead halls, Hrothgar in Denmark, Beowulf in basically Sweden, in Geatland, presiding over their mead hall nation, basically, where all their retainers sit around swilling mead and listening to Shope sing heroic songs. And that may have happened. It didn't come from nowhere. And I'm sure that there are genuine cultural recollections from the Migration Age period. How much of that comes forward into later periods of the early Middle Ages? Nobody really knows. The thing about mead halls, see, they're made of wood too. So when you're talking about someone's hall, what archaeologists see are rows of holes in the ground.
Yeah.
That's about all that remains.
Okay.
And so all the reconstructions of mead halls, based on some cultural information, especially from Scandinavian peoples, where, you know, architectural styles hung on to the old Germanic thing a bit farther.
Let's go to the swan.
Oh, lovely.
And this is another example, or the first example that we're going to read, of one where the object of the riddle is describing themselves. So it's giving voice to the swan.
That's right. Okay, so here it comes. My attire falls silent when I tread the earth, or turn to my abode and stir the waters. Sometimes my raiment and this lofty air convey me high above the dwellings of men, and then the strength of the clouds conveys me far across the nation. My get-up whooshes loudly and resonates and brightly sings once I leave water and earth behind, a wandering spirit.
Now, there seems to be more to this than it's just a bird sitting on a pond.
Oh, yeah.
So what's going on in this riddle?
All kinds of things. Mostly evocative things, and that is also another quality of the riddles, because they're telling you about their subject, or the subject is telling you about itself, but they don't want to tell you too much. They want to give you good poetry to start off with and enough clues that you can work out the solution. Presumably, some of them have never been worked out because the clues are so obscure. But in the case of the swan, it's all evocation. It's this creature is all you have to go on that's talking to you and tells you about how it travels through material creation in all of its mediums, earth, water, air. It just leaves out fire. It's not a salamander, I guess, in that way. And it's part of a collection of bird riddles in that form. I've collected them all in one piece for the first chapter in my book. And every one of them relates the same vision of different birds, like swan, jay, cuckoo, we get a few. But the birds all embody a kind of expansive vocality, is the best way I can put it. There's the emphasis on, of course, on flight, and bird wings in medieval manuscripts are absolute shorthand for the angelic. You can slap a wing, set of wings on anything, and it becomes the spirit of. Think of those. I think I mentioned it. Those muscle-bound Syrian bulls on carved reliefs in Mesopotamia, and they're muscled like Arnold Schwarzenegger, thick knotted muscles, but they got wings on them. You know, usually pathetically small for lifting all that mass. But the point is, they are a certain kind of spirit. And so, of course, they have wings in that way. So that's the swan, and all birds participate in that a little bit. And then there's something about sound. And there are a lot of songbirds, jay, nightingale, and a few others. I make the point, I try to make the point in that chapter, that these birds all seem poet avatars, that they seem to embody something about the Anglo-Saxon poet's own sense of his own craft. And so that's part of what attracts them, because there's a good few bird riddles in the collection. The swan specifically, though, relies on a particular bit of folklore to do with not the swan song, which is a later Renaissance conceit of the song the swan sings as it dies, but rather it's not even a song, it's that its feathers, when it flies, make musical sound. I've lived in England near ponds, and I've heard swans taking off, and they make a lot of noise, but I wouldn't qualify this as music, really, on the one hand. So I don't know if that's natural observation. I think part of what the poets are doing, they have a motif that occurs in other poetry, happens in Beowulf and quite a few other ones, where warriors, when they are marching along, usually when they're getting onto a ship or getting off a ship, it says that their raiment sings. There's specific verbs that are used, and same for what's used for the swan here. So the notion of singing clothing, and of course that's a reference to the mail shirt of the warrior, you know, the
made of chain.
Yeah, chain mail, yeah. Some people call it now.
Yeah.
And it would make a kind of rustling, tinkly kind of sound as you moved. And that was music to the ears of certain poets, you know, that was the sound of a well-kitted out warrior. But the swan seems to share a little bit in that it's covered in something that makes a pleasing sound.
Yeah, but it seems to be more than that, because mm-hmm. the last three lines, my get-up whooshes loudly, resonates and brightly sings. Once I leave water and earth behind, a wandering spirit.
Of course.
What's the wandering spirit? I mean, that's more than a bird flying to the next pond.
Fahrender Geist, that is. And yeah, the word for spirit there is one that's modern English guest, and it means something like visitant, someone who, you know, fly in, fly out kind of figure. And that's a common medieval Christian way of conceiving of the human soul.
Right.
That it rests here in time and space for its spell, but where it comes from and where it goes, the Christian knows technically, but it can't be demonstrated. And that ending there of the wandering spirit, I mean, look, certainly Western culture has found migratory birds evocative from the get-go. You know, the notion of these winged things that, you know, rise above it all. You know, rise above the earth and the water, those more solid foundations of its existence. And when it takes to the air, it travels farther and higher and much nearer to, you know, the elevated plains up there.
Right.
If nothing
closer
else.
To heaven.
Yeah.
Yeah. The wandering spirit reaching heaven. Who
look
knows?
Look at any depiction of angels in a medieval or Renaissance manuscript. It's always swan wings.
Yes.
Because they're big and fluffy and white.
Yeah. Beautiful. Okay, well, this is all we've got time for this program, but we'll make a second program.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm talking to Robert DiNapoli about his new book, Reading Old English Riddles, The Dark Glass. And my name is Di Cousins, and this is the Spoken Word program. Thank you.